as opposed to solving the Schrödinger equation, which you might have noticed requires quite a bit of manual input in the sense that you have to know what you're doing. Doing Monte Carlo simulation, it's sort of a rite of passage. You have to do it once in your life. Today I'll talk a little bit about linear systems, and then I'll move on to talking about Monte Carlo methods. So I just wanted to tell you something about iterative methods. Again, the name of the game is that suppose we want to solve a really large set of linear equations, then how could we do this? So we're looking to solve something, again, where AX is equal to B. Well, what we can do here is that I can write that A is equal to Q and then plus A. And that would, of course, work if I immediately subtract off Q, right? So far, it looks like I'm just not doing anything, right? But if I then go up and compare to what I have up here, then this one here, it would just become qx here, and then plus a minus q of x is equal to b. Or I could write it as qx here is equal to q minus a times x plus b. So, well, why am I doing this? Well, I want to arrive at a point where I have some equations that I can iterate. And suppose I go in here and say that q of x k plus 1 here, that's equal to q minus a here, and then xk, and then plus b, then you could see that this equation here, I can think about iterating. And that becomes very, very important, for some people at least. So if I look at this, and I imagine that I iterate this, and I'll talk 2 seconds about how we would iterate it, then you can see that this would eventually converge to something that would be q star here equal to q minus a and then x star and then plus b. Okay. And this we hope at least. And if we arrive at this, then we can see that if I have this, then it would mean that x star here is the solution to the original equation, right? Okay, so we all agree that writing it in this form at least is allowed. We see here that I can think about a matrix like this and then try to do this. So obviously, we should choose Q in a clever manner. So for those of you who remember what I ended up doing yesterday, can you see a clever way of choosing Q here? What would you do if you were trying to do this?
Um, something perpendicular?
Yeah. So why would that be good? That's because you could say here that, well, what I want here is x of k plus 1. And I know the right-hand side. So actually, in what I have here is something of the form like that. So I want a matrix that we can easily invert and then solve for x and k plus 1, right? Okay. So the other thing here is that so basically we want to choose q here so that this xk plus 1 here equal to y can be solved easily. And then the second criterion is that we want to make sure that things converge. But so Chris suggested that, well, OK, if Q here is, and I should remember to say triangular. So if it's upper or lower triangular, yeah, I call everything tridiagonal, I know. But so if it's upper or lower triangular, then I can solve this by backtracking. We also saw how that could be done very quickly, right? But suppose we not even want to be that fancy. Can you think of something even simpler?
Nope.
Yes, yes, yes. So we can just do it. How about so the how about just doing so how about well, let's just say that Q here is diagonal. And so, but what kind of diagonal matrix would you choose? Well, I don't know. You could choose the identity. But if you go over and look on the other side here, and then you remember something with matrix norms that you're iterating something here, what?
Eigenvalues of A.
Oh, God, that would be clever. I don't know. You should try.
No, no. Just anytime somebody says, "What are n numbers about this matrix?"
No, but I. So what we could do is that we could set Q equal to the diagonal elements of A, right? Because if I do that, then you can see I'm going to be repeatedly applying a matrix here, and probably if I remove all the diagonal elements, its matrix norm is going to go down. So I could hope for something that would be converging. So this here is called, I believe, Jacobi's method. So this is called a Jacobi iteration. So Jacobi did many things, and he has a method for a great.
This is not necessarily critical. Right, you need all those elements to be not zero.
Yeah. So you would rearrange your equation, so it does become invertible. Otherwise, you're going to get over, you're going to get in trouble over here, right? Of course, you know that, well, hopefully the system that you're trying to solve is actually solvable. I can do this, and that would mean that this here becomes very simple, and hopefully that would be converging. So the other thing you can do goes by the name of Gauss Seidel iteration. And that is exactly what Chris suggested. So we set Q here. We set Q equal to, for instance, the lower or upper triangular part of A, right? That would mean if I go over here and then look at what I have left, and if I include here the diagonal, then you can see that I could solve this by backtracking, and I would end up with a matrix over here that would only have elements above the diagonal. And these matrices, when you start iterating them, will probably converge rather quickly. Okay. There. Here's my last. So we have to look at a little bit at how things are converging. So so let's see if we can figure this out, right? So I want to go back to my equation over here. And so I would say that x of k plus 1 here, it should be equal to q minus 1, and then apply to everything that we have here, plus b. Okay? So this I write now as some matrix, and then apply to xk, and then plus y, right? And if we look at this, then C here is obviously I, and then minus this. And Y here is, of course, equal to Q minus 1 applied to B. Okay. So then I look at the error. So I can look at EK here, which is x of k here, and then minus x, right? So what would this be? Oh, am I tripping in the power cord here? So this would be 1 and then minus q minus 1 applied to a here, of x of k. Actually, x of k minus 1, and then plus y here, which we write as q minus 1 applied to b, and then minus x here. and then I can say, well, b here, I can write this as ax here. So actually, what I have here is 1 minus q minus 1 applied to a here, and then xk minus 1. And then I would get something here, which is q minus 1 a minus I here applied to x, right? And this I can now rearrange. So I end up with something here, which is 1, and then q minus 1 a, and then apply to x of k minus 1 minus x. So in other words, I know that I minus Q minus 1 A here applied to the error at the K minus first step will give me the error at step K, right? So we want this one to go or to be close to zero. So basically, if we want to answer this question here, then in some sense, this here, or well, Q minus 1 applied to A here should be close to the identity matrix. And it's, of course, not all that surprising when I look at the simple trick that I applied here that if indeed, of course, I can choose Q to be the inverse of A here, then I would be in business. And this means that you can actually prove some theorems. Which is based on this. So there are some convergence theorems for when this will actually work. So if I look here at Q of x of k plus 1, which is equal to Q minus A of x k here, and then plus b. So if I want this to convert independent of x 0, my starting point. Again, most iterative techniques, of course, will converge if you can guess the actual solution, right? But of course, you can't, right? So if you want this to convert, it is a necessary and sufficient condition that all eigenvalues of I minus Q minus 1 A here, what do you think we need to require for these eigenvalues? If I go over and look at what? What? Yeah, basically, right? So they should lie in the open unit circle. Right. So sometimes this is written that the this here has to be less than 1. But pretty easy to go back and see here if what I'm iterating with actually has an eigenvalue that's bigger than 1 here, then you could see that my error could be growing. Unless my initial guess would be orthogonal to that part of the eigenspace. So there are some analysis that can be done here if you're confronted with some huge set of linear equations and you want to solve them. There are actually a number of this is of course an incredibly important application. So this is called the spectral radius theorem. Okay, so the other thing that you can look at is whether the matrix is diagonally dominant or not. So what does this mean? It would mean that the diagonal element here, it is bigger than the sum over all the other elements in that column, right? If that's the case, then we would say that the matrix is diagonally dominant. And you can probably guess that if this is the case, then the simple Jacobi method, where it would just be iterating by separating out the diagonal, it might work here. So basically, what you can show here is that A, if A here is diagonally dominant, then Jacobi and Gauss-Seidel here converge for any x0. So I just want to tell you about one problem that is sort of interesting. And so this problem was discussed in a series of papers by from 1998. That's actually surprising. By Larry Page here and his colleague Bryn. So what did these two guys do? What? Yeah. Who are these guys? Yeah, they.
I didn't realize his name was Page, so PageRank is kind of.
It's kind of tacky. So yeah. I'm still amazed that this is. Well, probably today, 11 years ago, right? And they were your age, right? They were. I can't remember. And so they looked at this problem, right? So let me see if I can. It's actually an interesting problem. Before that, what people were looking in for search algorithms, you were sort of just trying to index the web here. And what they proposed was a method for ranking web pages. So I'm going to do a little example here, and I'll have the entire web to correspond to just 6 web pages, right? It'll show the basic underlying idea here. And what you'll see is that we end up with a problem from linear algebra that we can try to solve by iteration. And it actually becomes a problem for them to prove that you can actually iterate to a solution. And that meant that they had some additional inventions that needed to be looked at. So these are the six pages, and what we're interested in is how these pages refer to each other, right? So we have six web pages. And when I put an arrow here from page 1 to page 2, then it means that there's a link. So when I'm looking at page 1, I can go to page 2, right? Then there's also a link here from page 3 to page 2. And then page 1 and page 3 here, they're very nice because they're linking to each other. And then page 3 here, it points to page 5. And page 5 here, it points to 6. And then back and forth with 4 here. And then these two pages also refer to each other. What they suggested was that you look at this, and then you associate what's called a page rank, and then, well, we're back to this, right? So there's a correspondence, right? You wonder what would have happened if his name wasn't Page here, right? So what you do is that you define the rank of a given page, and here I would run from 1 to 6 here. And what is done here is that it's defined by its peers, right? So we have to sum over all the pages that are pointing to PI here. So we look at all the pages, and for instance, if we want to get the rank for page number 3 here, it's fairly easy because I would just be looking at page number 1 because it's the only one that's pointing to it, right? So what you say here is that it's a sum over then the rank of those pages, but then modified by how many links they have, right? So what I call PJ here, that would be the number of outgoing links. From PJ. So if I look at it, then I would say here PJ is equal to 3. Here PJ is equal to 0. Here I would have PJ is equal to 2. Here I would have PJ equal to 2 again, and here it would be 2, and over here it would be equal to 1. So this means that I can now I know what the PJs are here, and I can just go in and I can write down now a matrix for this. So we would get a matrix of the following form here. So we'd have 0, then 1/2, 1/2 here, 0, 0, 0, then 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, corresponding to this node here. And then we do a third, 0, 0, a third here, and a 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 0, 0. So you're basically now looking at then some problem like this that you have to solve. Right? And so what they decided to do is to try to solve this by iteration. And that actually means that you get a serious problem with these matrices because you have to be able to prove that it's actually gonna converge. So the actual matrix that they use to determine the page rank is not something as simple as this. You arrive at what's called the Google matrix, which has a couple of terms added to it. Notably, you can see here that I would end up with a line here describing the fact that there are no outgoing links from node number 2. So what they did, what they would argue was that when you're surfing the web, then you might actually go in and then land on page 3 and then click on a link up to page number 2 and then on another link, and that would take you to page number 2, yeah, right? So you go from 3, 1, and up to 2, but then you get stuck there because there are no outgoing links. And then they argue that you get bored. And what do? Well, at random, you type in any web page, and then you sort of just jump there. And that would mean that you would go in here and you would say that I would replace this entire line by 1 over 6, indicating the probability that I could at random go to any other site in my little network. And then you have to be adding another term, and then you finally arrive at what's called the Google matrix. And this is, of course, a whole industry. But just imagine that you count all the web pages and you try to solve this linear algebra problem. That's heavy duty. Well, that's what they looked at 11 years ago, and then they created Google. It's sort of interesting what is behind the search technology. So I wanted to, there's one point here that I wanted to tell you about, because, yes?
The ranking of the page, if it contains even the menu link itself.
If you can see here, it's a sum here over the pages that are pointing to it. So you can't cheat. And that was, of course, so this is like peer review. You can make friends and you can tell them to point to your page. But you can't sort of just point to yourself infinitely many times and get your ranking up. There's more to this, of course, and Google, they make a lot of money when you type in something in their search engine and so forth. Suppose I had just 2 pages. Right, so I would have something like this. Then I would claim that my matrix here, it would now be very simple to write down, because it would just be 0, 1, 1, 0, right? I think initially when they proposed this ranking, when they started iterating this equation here, so this is a step k and then k plus 1, their starting point was having all pages equal. But you could go in and imagine that your starting would be having all the rank on site number 1 and 0 on site number 2. And then you get something that's interesting because it'll just immediately give you 0, 1, right? And then you iterate this here. And then the next iteration step is going to bring you back to your starting point. And that creates something that's called a limit cycle. And that's annoying. We don't want the limit cycle. You could also see here that if I go in and then I look at a vector here, which would be giving equal rank to the two vectors, then that works fine. I'm going to get 1 and 1 back, right? So if we try to iterate an innocently looking matrix like this, I could happen on arriving at a simple fixed point here. And I could get a limit cycle, even though the underlying matrix here is very simple. As you may have guessed, what's underlying a lot of this is the theory of Markov chains and stochastic matrices. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is, yeah. So there's a very nice little book here that's called The Page Rank and Beyond, with anything Google in it. And it sort of looks at the mathematics underlying all of this, and it's quite readable. I'm not going to... It would be interesting to tell you a lot about search engines, but I don't know much about it, and this is theoretical physics, so... What we're going to talk about is Monte Carlo simulations. So, yes?
There's a site that Michael Nielsen maintains that's about Google technology stats. So
oh, okay. Okay, yeah, I should have a look at it. The, it's the quantum computing guy?
Yeah. He taught a class on Google's implementation of PageRank.
Should have a look at that. So what we're going to switch and talk about is, where's the eraser going? We're going to look at some of these problems. So we'll talk about, largely what is called Monte Carlo simulations. But before we do this, I want to say a few words about random numbers. I always do this, and I'm not going to ask you, but yes.
So clearly, if you have a larger graph in the adjacency graph, and you have like a Sorry, that came out wrong. So there you have like a circle, like a permutation. I don't know what you call it. It's like a fixed subspace.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you have a larger ring, like any ring like that, clearly the average of the, like if you take the average of a limit cycle, you'll get a fixed point, right? Like here.
Well, there are a lot of theorems for what you have to do to your matrix to avoid this.
Yeah. Well,
underlying problems.
My question was, if you find yourself in a limit cycle, can you take the average of a limit cycle and get what you wanted? Like, because in this case, you can.
Yeah, in this case, you can. Well, the problem is that they could, of course, be very complicated. So this is a two-step limit cycle. And if you go in and they become n-step and whatnot, I'm not sure, to be honest. And the underlying problem is, how would you ever know?
If you do the iteration enough times, you'll know. Okay.
Yeah, but if the limit, yeah, anyway.
There's a limit, okay.
So the... So I guess, you know, if you could detect that you had a limit cycle of 2,000 or so, or 2,037, then you would need, then maybe you could work your way out of it.
So problems appear when you don't iterate enough times when you do like the small iteration approximation?
I was just going to say each one of these page rank vectors is 7 gigabytes.
Right, but like you don't expect enormous limit cycles. I mean, well, we can never know.
What they actually do, and what is called the Google matrix, you can mathematically prove that this does occur. So they add elements to basically they add the the matrix, which is all ones, with a small probability, and that means that stuff like I just showed can't occur. But it's a very it's a very interesting question to think about. And also why you would do this. So we're going to talk about simulations. And when we do simulations, then we will have to exploit what are called random numbers. So can any of you tell me something that is entirely random?
Defined numbers.
Well, that's a good answer. That's a good.
Oh, yes. Chaitin's omega constant.
What?
we went to a seminar on this. The digits of Gregory Chaitin's omega constant. That's entirely right.
Okay. If you look at the digits in pi or something like that.
Actually, I'm not sure it's very true, because people have tried to prove that the digits of pi are random. And you can see experimentally that they are.
So the do you know of physical processes that you would call random?
Quantum mechanics.
Yeah. So what would you be looking at in quantum mechanics?
Radiation.
Yeah. You could be looking. So suppose that you were to look at radiation. The problem is that you would actually have to detect it, right? So even though you could probably argue that in some interpretation of quantum mechanics it should be random, you would have to detect that signal, and then you're back to looking at your detector efficiency. Can you actually interact with this quantum system so that the end result is going to be totally random? More importantly here, you could... as you were pointing out, you have to sort of ask yourself, what do you mean by random? What we are after here is random numbers. And usually, we want them with a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. That would be nice, because then we can interpret them as some kind of probability. Usually, I want to point out here that what we get is actually integers between maybe 0 and some imax, or maybe they start in 1. And that imax would be the biggest integer you could generate with your representation of integer.
And we talked about how we represent integers, and so if you want to convert back to something between 0 and 1, you divide by I max here. So we have to look at this and then see how we can get hold of this. That actually used to be that you could buy random numbers. So you could say to yourself, well, I don't trust my computer, and maybe I shouldn't. So I'll just buy high quality random numbers on a DVD. Right? So I can go and buy a million or a billion, maybe a trillion. You know, it's not funny. and then you start a company and you generate high quality random numbers with low correlations and so forth, and produce them on a DVD. The problem with this is that the simulations that are performed today have become so huge that you need an enormous number of random numbers, and they have to be of increasing quality. And we'll get back to that. So if you were to generate them by, for instance, looking at nuclear decay and having some fancy process, looking at network traffic or whatnot, then eventually you're going to run out of them. So what you do is that we have to make do usually here with what are called pseudo-random numbers. By this we mean that we have some algorithm, and I'll show you the very simplest one of this, of generating a random number if I know the previous one. So it's entirely a deterministic way of generating these random numbers. So if we again go back and say that actually what we're looking at is generating a sequence of integers that we then convert back to some floating point, I would get my next integer here from the previous one in the sequence. And you can see already that this is dangerous because now, since this is done deterministically, then if I know I a k here, then obviously I can predict what the next random number is going to be. And that's sort of inherent to all what we call RNGs here, that we build in correlations. And then eventually we close our eyes and cross our fingers and say probably and hopefully we can ignore those correlations. Something that we should always look at here is suppose I now give you a random number generator, and it's spitting out integers, and they look something like 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. And then down to the last one. So this here would be bit 0, and this would be bit 31 here, right? How would you decide whether this is random or not? What?
You generate more.
Okay, so we suppose we generate this one. So maybe it looks something like that. Then what would you do?
You have to define some type of correlation.
Yes. Well, say something.
Number of digits that are changed. I don't know. That's not a regular one.
Okay. So you could do sort of an XOR or something like this. So. So we could look at something like this. I could compare this with that one. So that would be the number of bits here that are changed. So what would you expect?
What would random mean? If that's your criterion, what would it mean to be random? How many events should be?
50% of them.
Yeah, so you're hoping for probably 50%. But again, of course, we would have to do this many, many times, right? OK, another criterion?
So like, if you take a sensible definition of randomness, it usually involves infinite sequences. And it's going to be something like, you know, Jen's agreement with complexity, right? Like something it's impossible to test for. So
this is very practical because, well, you know, you get the generator, and you can generate maybe a few hundred thousand,
so
and then you
like,
have to make a decision.
So it seems like it's silly to come up with criteria before we know what aspects of randomness we're going to need practically. Like, why do we need random numbers at all for our simulation? Like, for example,
well,
you could say we want to test and make sure that these are like algorithmically random, like in Jen's sense. But this is stupid because that's clearly not necessary because none of the pseudo-random sequences we ever generate.
Right, but you bring up a very good point because initially when people started doing Monte Carlo simulations, they said, all we do is to flip a coin. So all I want to know is if a number is basically bigger or smaller than a half. And we said, well, and then they said, well, you know, but any random number generator here, it doesn't, that would just mean that if I look at my integers here, then I would just hope for roughly half of them should be above a half when I converted them to a floating point, and the other one should be below half, and all the remaining correlations, I wouldn't really need to be concerned about that. And so that was fine until people then got clever and started building more and more involved simulations. Without knowing it, they actually used the fact that a whole sequence of random numbers were independent without correlations. And there's a famous paper that I have here. I can write the reference where I think from the mid-90s, where they actually then showed that people hadn't thought about this, and a lot of published papers had errors that were statistically significant. So due to the fact that they used low-quality random number generators, they obtained results that were off by, in some cases, 30 or 40 standard deviations. And so going back to what you mentioned here, that was precisely because they said, well, OK, I'm just flipping a coin, so I don't need anything. And they hadn't thought through what they were doing and how much they would actually need of, or how much correlation here they could tolerate. I'll give you a very specific example in 2 seconds here. But what could we test here? Yeah, you
can. Chi-square distribution.
OK, so how would you do that?
You calculate the F statistic on for the difference between the histogram of your random numbers and what you expect the histogram to be. That should follow chi-square distribution. And you
OK. Yeah, so we can run all kinds of statistical tests here. So there are two ways you can do this. You can run it in time here. So you'd be looking at your k and your k plus 1, k plus 2 here. And you want that to be 0. But you also want to know that correlations within your random number is 0, or they're uncorrelated. So it could be that bit number 29 is always the same as bit number 0. And you can try to think of how long time you would have to run your program before you realize that that was the case, right? My guess is that you would never notice. So you can look at correlations. You can also look at the patterns here. If I have a sequence of patterns like 110, does that occur more frequently than other patterns? So you could also imagine weird tests where bit number, OK, so this was actually bit number 29, right?
So this would be 8, so this would be bit number 26. I could look at the correlation between bit number 29 here and then sometime later, then bit number 26. And again, we want probably that that should be equal to 0. I can tell you something from bitter experience that you could easily imagine getting numbers and you get something like this, where that would be bit number 31 and this would be bit number 0. Then you go to the next number here, so that would be ik plus 1. And then your bits here, so-called low-order bits here, they were just never changed, right? Eventually, something like that, you will probably notice, because if you ran statistical tests and tried to look for it, then you should notice something like this. Initially, you can just crank it out, and you know the numbers all go random to you, and you won't notice that you're actually never modifying the three low order bits. This can be very painful. And actually, what is the relevant statistical test that you want to look at? It depends on the process you're trying to simulate. I just want you to reflect on this, and it becomes very crucial. So let me see if I can't give you the actual. Here we have. So if you want to, read about this, then go and have a look at PRB here, 69, page 3382 from 1992, where they looked at a number of these random number generators that were in very frequent use at that point, and what they would imply for error bars. So there's a whole technology, and of course, if you go and talk to people in number theory, they will tell you how to build a random number generator. And I don't do number theory, so I'm just going to tell you about the very simplest one that you can think of, which is the linear concurrential generator. Our ik plus 1, what you do is that you take I of k here, and then you multiply it by a constant, which we call a here. And then I add another constant to it. And then I do this modulus something big. Right? Okay. There's certain things here that are rather dangerous, but the ANSI C standard. I think I discussed this with one of you. I'm not entirely sure if that's actually written in the standard specification for C, but what they call RAN in C, at least when I started programming in C, used this random number generator, and A here is just 110351 5245. What do you think they took for C? No, they took 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. M here is 2 to the power of 32. And that would mean that if you do this on our 32-bit integers,
when I'm multiplying here with ordinary arithmetic, then the modulus here, I wouldn't have to do it because it's just going to be done with overflow. So that's fine, except for then you take their code and then you use it on a machine with 64-bit integers. And then you end up with a problem like this where, you know, nothing ever works. So it's very, you should be very, very careful by taking a working random number generator and then running it on a different CPU architecture. Then you actually have to know what's going on and make sure that these modulus operations, which they don't do. That's what you get with this one. So I'm just going to analyze this for 2 seconds, and then we can we'll see something. So I'm going to do my little random number generator. This is Eric's RNG here. So I take A equal to 3. I take C equal to 2. And I take M equal to 32. Okay, so that would actually mean that I'm looking at something where IK plus 1, it's equal to 3 times I of K, and then plus 2, and then mod 32. Okay, so what would happen? Well, if I start here with 1, what would the next number be? Higher math, right? We said 5, right? What would happen after 5? 17, yeah. It was, don't laugh yet, because this... I'll show you what went wrong in some of these. What happens when we do 17? Well, I multiply by 3, then I get 61, and then I have to do the modulus here. So I do a little hop because that means that I did a modulus here, and then I get a 21. And then if you do this again, I end up with the number 1. So this here you can see creates what is called a cycle. And this is a rather small cycle. And obviously it means that if you start with some random number, then you want to make you want to have some kind of assurance that you get a periodicity in your random number sequence which is rather high. You don't want just to have 4 different numbers. So this here is a cycle of length 4, right? So we have to make sure, probably by some number theory, to see how we're multiplying these numbers together to make sure that we get long cycles. Obviously, you can see that what is called the periodicity, which is the highest cycle that we can achieve here, it's obviously less than m. So this random number, even though it looks like it's great, it has an m here, which is 2 to the power of 32. What is 2 to the power of 32? Yeah, it's about 4 billion, right? So this ANSI-C standard random number generator, it cannot have a cycle that exceeds 4 billion. And today, it's actually very simple to set up a little Monte Carlo simulation where you're using many more random numbers than that. And you would just be then repeating the same simulation, yeah.
I haven't done numbers here in a while, but if you choose
m to be prime, does your cycle go through every number before it comes back?
Well, you can look at this, and obviously there are theories here where A and C and mod should be chosen as mutual primes, and you can show it's better, and so forth. And I'm not going to, I personally don't know much about it. What I just want to show you here is that if you don't worry about it, things can go terribly wrong. But you're entirely right. There are clever ways of choosing these constants, and this is obviously very stupid, right? If I do 2 here, then it goes to 8,
then goes to 26, and then I pop back again, so I get 16, then I get 18 here, and then I get 24, and then I get 10, and then I go to 0, and then I'm back to 2. So you can see suddenly I got a cycle here that was longer. But still, you know, on the face of it, if I look at a sequence, you can see initially I start off and 1, 5, and 17, you might actually be able to guess the underlying constant because you can see it's just lying on a straight line. But once the modulus kicks in, then it's hard to see what is the relation between 26, 16, 18, and 24. And you could run your statistical tests on the 32 different numbers that we could get out here. And if you run a little sequence like this, then you could imagine that it might actually look reasonable. So what we can do here is that I can write out the entire random number generator sequence. Because if I look at a given random number, then I can immediately determine the next one. So you can see if I start with 0, then I get 2. And then I can just continue here. So 1 here, it's going to give me 5. Then I'll get 8. Then I'll get 11. Then I'll get 14. Then I'm going to get 17, 20, 23, 26 here. And then 29. And then I'm back to 0 because I hit the modulus. Then I start off with 3 here. So, and you can continue here. So what did people actually do? Well, they were running simulations, for instance, in fluid mechanics or cosmology. And they used a random number generator to put particles on a lattice. So that's the most simple example I know of using two random numbers in sequence, where you're will all say, well, okay, what could it matter that there would be any correlation between the two random numbers? If I use this random number generator, you can see that what I would be doing here is that, well, maybe I'll start with 0, and then I'll put in a particle here in 0 and 2. Then the next one here would be 5 and 17. So this is maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then 17 would be up here. And then after that, then we would be looking at 21 and 1, right? So that would be something out here, right? Do these points look random to you?
There's only 3 points.
Yeah, there are only 3, okay. Obviously, if we continue this and exhaust all that we can do with the random number generator, then I'm going to get all these pairs. And you can see that they'll just line up. I guess I drew this slightly incorrectly. They'll line up on basically the straight line, which is y equal to 3x plus 2, and then mod 32. So they'll be lying on 3 lines like this. And of course, when you run it, what you'll see is that I'll get this point, then I'll get that, then I'll get one here, then I'll get one there. And things look random to you. And you don't realize here that I just have 3 lines in the 2D plane. And So amazingly, so that's another test that you don't. So for the ANSI C here generator that I wrote out before, you could say, well, okay, in that case, I have my M here, which is 2 to the 32. Suppose that I now use random numbers R1, R2, and R3 to put points in R3. How many planes do you think I'm going to get? So in this case, I'll get two-dimensional planes. It's not going to be lines. The points here will line up on planes, right? It actually turns out that the maximum number I can get here is roughly 1,600 planes. But that's probably enough that you wouldn't notice, right? So it's very simple to go in and say, well, you know, I just want to start out a simulation, and so, you know, I put off, put some points on a lattice, and I don't realize that I'm building in all these correlations from previous points. So now people realize this, and then they say, oh, well, we can just try to fix it. So what you do is that you build something that there are many, many random number generators. And so one of them is called the Fibonacci generator. Can you guess what that might be doing? Nobody wants to. What you do here is that you you would say here that IK, well, it's equal to IK minus 1 plus IK minus 2, right? And then actually you usually throw in a modulus, some other C here. So the fancier random number generators, what you typically do is that you take a low quality generator, like a linear congruential one, and then you try to mix it up, stir up the bits a bit, right? Because if I had a problem with the points lying on planes like this, then if I had fit those numbers into sort of a second step where I had done something like this, then maybe those correlations would have gone. People are saying, well, that's not good enough. So you can do what's called a lagged Fibonacci. And that would be, for instance, saying that I of k here, well, it's maybe I of k minus r, and then I of k minus s. So I would have to maybe take a string of 252 random numbers, and then when I want to get the next one, I take the r and s one downstream, and then I combine them, and you could say, well, why just add them? I could also multiply them, I could subtract them, you know, I could divide them. And then maybe again I'd want to do some mod C here. So quite typically, if you look at these algorithms here, you take a low quality random number generator, and then you try to stir things up, and then of course you run into your problems here, because maybe you have killed this problem, because you're no longer going to be lying on hyperplanes, but can you actually prove that this one is going to pass all your tests here? So people work at this, and if you want to have a look at some tests that are proposed for these random number generators, you can go and type in the keyword diehard in Google, and Google will solve a linear equation for you, and it'll tell you that this is a
a web page maintained by a guy called Massiglio, where he has proposed a sort of a battery of tests. I think he's up to 20 or 30. And of course, they ran all these tests on all the commonly used random number generators, and they all failed at least one or two. Today they're fairly good, high quality random number generators. And I think I talked to you about this, that there's what's called the Mersenne twister. So you may know about prime numbers. So there's called the what I call the Mersenne prime numbers, which is 2^-1. And you can build random number generators that exploits results from number theory to try to do something that's better. I would expect that it's probably just a question of time before somebody thinks of a test that some of these random number generators will fail. And then we have to figure out why and correct for it. But the point is that you should look at what you need the random numbers for and see if you're ever using them in sequence with the unconscious assumption that they're uncorrelated. And think of this example here of x and y coordinates. What went really wrong in this paper here was that people developed what is called cluster Monte Carlo methods, which is sort of a great algorithmic advance, where you build a little cluster and you try to move it or update it. And in building that cluster, they used a sequence of random numbers, which was not one or two, but maybe a few thousand numbers to construct the actual cluster. And that, of course, meant that they became very, very susceptible to high-order correlations. So it was not enough that you could say, well, you know, if I, you know, some of the bits here were uncorrelated, but you depended on the fact that I of k and then I of k, 1,000 numbers down, were statistically independent. That's hard. Of course, you didn't think about this because people just took their trusted random number generator that had always worked, and then they fed it into this. Okay, so I didn't have. So I'll tell you about Monte Carlo methods tomorrow then. And let's go and have lunch. If there are no questions.